Want to make a difference in your community but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously. Your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend, or family member, or an organization. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe is backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works, and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
Welcome back to the Beyond Broadcast Podcast, a show which takes a behind-the-scenes look at industry professionals and their lives working in the broadcasting and entertainment industry. Today, I'm speaking with New Zealand-born, well, it turns out not New Zealand-born, UK-born, but New Zealand-raised and Singapore-based podcast consultant and owner-operator of CLW Media, Charlotte Lewis-West. Writing breaking stories as a journalist, copywriting for the corporate world, or creating audio for up-and-coming content creators, Charlotte is a master wordsmith, a skill that has gotten her work around the globe. Now Charlotte is the secret weapon for podcasters looking to maximize their success through strategy. Welcome to the show, Charlotte, and such a pleasure to see you again after almost a decade. How are you doing?
Oh, it is absolutely lovely to be here. Lovely to see you. And thank you for such a wonderful introduction. I don't know if I can live up to that, but thank you.
I think most people always do. And I'm going to ask the boring question since you've spent so much time in the UK. How is the weather in Singapore, especially because you're a day ahead of me? It's the morning now. How are you set at the minute?
Oh my goodness, the weather here is ridiculously sticky and hot. It is sort of 85-90% humidity, and I am living in the aircon at the moment.
I feel like I have the exact same experience as you. Like, it's only in the last like 2 or 3 months now that it's hilarious, because I complain about the heat here because I'm based in Argentina, yeah. But it's absolutely freezing now, and it's kind of goes between like complaining about it being too hot and now complaining about it being too cold. I never get an in-between. Is that kind of the same thing in Singapore, or no, is it a bit more even?
Well, the weather never really changes here, apart from you get the wet season and the dry season, but the temperature remains pretty much the same, and you just have more or less humidity and then the tropical thunderstorms. But I am exactly the same as you. I am never happy with the weather, and I really am jealous that you get some cold weather, because I miss jackets, boots, layers. All of that is just stashed away here. I haven't seen a sweater in about, 6 months.
I feel like it's killed my fashion sense to a degree, the summer here. Like, it gets to the point that I'm just like, I permanently look like I'm on holiday. And it's like, I just want to wear a nice scarf and a beanie every now and then, you know, change it up a little bit. Is that kind of the same experience for you?
Exactly. You can only wear one layer. So how do you make that look sort of stylish or do anything? And then once you're out and about, you're sweaty and gross anyway. But yeah, my partner walks around and I just look at him sometimes. I'm like, you look like you've just come off the beach in Bali, just living in our apartment. Because as you say, it's just so damn hot. So yeah, there's no way of making it particularly stylish.
Yeah. And the whole maybe 3 showers in one day is something that has definitely taken me a long time to get used to.
Exactly. I know. You've just got to do it. And cold showers. I mean, I never knew how refreshing they were, but it's kind of key to staying cool. But yeah, and it's crazy to think that you were in Argentina. I mean, yeah. How insane.
Well, it's even wetter for you. Well, that's the thing. It's even weirder to think about the perspective that you're in Singapore. And we were kind of talking off air about the fact that it's kind of strange. It's been 10 years. We've both in a similar sort of way had the journey of doing the whole New Zealand to UK thing and then traveling to like a completely even more foreign place to kind of like test the waters and see what's happening. And we're definitely going to dip into that a bit further. But I think a really good place to start, which was interesting to learn before we jumped on, was the fact that you were born in the UK. But we'll start from an even later point, which is the classic question that a lot of people always get asked during their kind of schooling years, is the classic thing of what school did you go to? And if I'm not mistaken, you went to St. Andrew's College, so SAC, which is what a lot of people know it by. And the thing I know about SAC from my time living in Christchurch and kind of being around that sort of scenario was that they were well known for having a pretty good media program. If I'm not mistaken, they had their own inbuilt television studio. Is that true? And at that point, were you dipping into that yourself? And was that kind of the beginning of you, Charlotte Lewis-West, kind of being like, I can see myself being involved in media?
Well, you are correct. They do have a really good, and I'm sure it's far better now, but they have an amazing media suite when we were there. And I did do those sort of television classes. And that's when I first started learning about the process behind television and radio. And, you know, as you know very well, it's so much more complicated than you think it is. That's sort of where I kind of learned a little bit more about the editing process, how things come together. And I fell in love with that technical side. But actually, my sort of dream of being a journalist started, I think, when I was really young. I used to be a pilot. We flew a lot. And we were staying in all sorts of different hotels all over the world. And I often couldn't sleep. And my parents used to put on the news for me. I don't quite know why, but you'd have sort of CNN or BBC playing in the background. And I remember being young and watching things, all sorts of conflicts and different kind of world events unraveling on television and seeing the people there on the ground telling the story. And that's where I kind of actually sort of fell in love with storytelling, hitting people. And from then on, probably about the age of 8 years old, I learned that that could be a career. And ever since then, have been wanting to do it. That was the spark of the journey. And then actually, you're right, at St. Andrews, sort of seeing the technical side of how it could come alive kind of kept me going.
I love how the BBC News ident was probably like your lullaby for sleeping on like long flights. I can imagine it. It's quite a bop and it goes pretty hard. So yeah, that totally makes sense. In terms of like, was there any particular like story or kind of like journalist that you felt was like really influential for you like in those early years? Was there anyone from like the BBC that you kind of still now think back and you're like, yeah, that was someone that I could see myself being like in the same sort of manner? Or no, was it sort of like a generalized kind of feeling that you're like, I can see myself just doing this role?
I think the most sort of pivotal point that I can remember is watching the Bosnian conflict unravel. You know, it was on every news station. And I remember just watching these women in their flak jackets reporting and just seeing how strong they were, seeing how they were able to connect with community members, be on the ground, asking the questions and telling the story that without them, you wouldn't understand it, sort of that ground-based level. And that was the real point for me where I thought, that's what I wanted to. My dream was actually to be a war correspondent. And that's what I always wanted. And it was ever since seeing those women on the ground, being able to tell that story and connect the viewer to what was actually happening in an authentic way. And I just think that ever since that moment, that's what I've watched. And I've looked back on women like Kate Adey, you know, sort of these monumental people who have gone on to do incredible things in dangerous situations just to allow us to understand what's happening, but also to tell the truth in areas where that often gets misinterpreted. So I think probably someone like Kate Adey was huge. Was a huge influence for me, but just seeing those people do it was the big catalyst.
It's also like a sense of like the rock star kind of dangerous lifestyle was kind of appealing to you in a sense, because I feel like war correspondence is kind of the, even though it's terrifying, it is the sexiest side of the news because it is here, happening right now, right then. Was it a little element of that, or no, was it more or less like you said, the kind of breaking down of the story, being able to kind of give a more wider overview of the situation that's maybe happening that maybe other people don't see?
Probably a bit of both, to be honest. You're right. There is something pretty cool about seeing someone put that sort of press jacket on and walk into the field and just start telling a story. I mean, that's pretty exciting. And I guess I was back in New Zealand wanting a little bit of an element of danger, a bit of excitement, and that looked pretty cool. So I think probably a mixture of both. You've hit that on the head.
Because I think as you said that your father was a pilot, is also an element of the whole traveling thing, seeing far-flung places. Like journalists do usually get, obviously not every journalist, but a lot of journalists do have the opportunity to travel and to see things they may not ever see. And is it kind of also a sense of like you were a born traveler, having been around that at such a young age?
Definitely. Absolutely. And I think, you know, we moved when I was around 6 years old to New Zealand. It was a tricky move. You know, it took a while to settle. And I think ever since then, I'd always been wanting to go back to the UK, but also travel further afield. And I think that travel bug, it definitely came from my mum, was very much kind of nurtured inside. So you're right. I always had that dream of traveling for work, moving around. And probably, if I'm honest, I was ready to go and to get out of New Zealand and see more and do more. But yeah, that travel bug has always been there. And as we were saying before, here we are. We've gone London, we've gone Singapore, probably another few countries to go. So I seem to be unable to fully settle.
Is it kind of funny in a sense because you're having a sense of identity from both countries, both the UK and New Zealand, which I don't know if you would agree with this statement, but I find like a lot of Kiwis, particularly have this kind of sense of like, because we're such a small country, it does feel like you need to get out of it every now and then. Is that kind of the similar sort of thought process that you had? It's like, there's so much more to the world than just Little World New Zealand, where you can drive from the top to the bottom in like a day and a half. Was that kind of a little bit as to the pushing factor of you being like, you know what, at some point I'm going to get a job, I'm going to be a journalist, I'm going to go see these amazing places and try and see the world?
It is, you're right. And I mean, New Zealand is an incredible country and I feel very lucky to have grown up there. There's actually so much more and you appreciate it so much more, don't you, once you are out of it. I think that's really a very strong feeling. But yeah, I was always wanting to go further. I wanted to see more, as you say, do more. But that identity, not crisis, but the conflict of identities is so interesting because, as you say, I was born in the UK, we moved. I felt very British in New Zealand and I also felt like I didn't fit in for a long time. My accent was different. You know, we were different as a family and you try and find your place and that took quite a while. And then when I moved to the UK, I wasn't completely British either. I was in fact more Kiwi. And then you feel very proud of your New Zealandness whilst trying to kind of embed yourself into British life, culture, etc., but always being probably on the outside slightly of that because you didn't grow up there, you know, you're different. And now we're in Singapore and now I am probably, again, there is that conflict of which one are you, who are you? And I think here it's a little bit more accepted that a lot of people have got the double passport. They may have been born in one country, grew up in another. But I still really struggle with that question of, you know, where are you from? Because it's a sort of a combination of both. So it is a bit of a cultural identity crisis, I suppose, that I'm still going through.
Do you feel like in the odd occasion you have these situations where perhaps you're hanging out with, because I know in Singapore there is like a high contingency of people that are from the UK, even though citizenship is quite hard to get, as you mentioned off air, or to get permanent residency or work visas, do you find yourself slipping into the identity based on who you're hanging out with? I certainly know for me, like maybe I play up my New Zealanderness if I'm especially around Australians, but then obviously if I'm with Argentines, maybe I dip into being a little bit more chill. Is that kind of something that you find yourself like slipping into yourself?
Yes, absolutely. I'm so pleased other people do this. Yes, I do. And I think it depends. Like, you know, if the All Blacks are playing, I'm fully Kiwi. If something else is going on. So I definitely pick and choose. But you're right. I think when you're with certain people, that brings out a certain element of you. When you hang out with Australians, you can't help but be more sort of Australasian. And then as soon as someone criticizes, you know, your end of the world, it's sort of like, oh my God, you know, band together. Whereas if you're with British people, I sort of slip naturally back into that way. So it's funny that you do the same thing. And I understand the playing up of New Zealandness is quite a funny thing that we all do. So you've made me feel better. Thank you.
That's good. Like, no, it makes me feel better as well. I had to just reaffirm that so that I'm not the only one that's slightly unhinged and does it like, yeah, it's bad. My friends always say to me, they're like, we understood you about 30 seconds ago until you were around Australians and now we have no idea what you're saying. It's like a mix of the slang and also the speed and velocity of me talking. They're just like, okay, now it's impossible. And
it's
mental. And so that moment, because you finish broadcasting school, we're ex-alumni as well, you would have done the internship. At what point were you like, I'm going to go to the UK? Was it like always a thought in the back of your mind? Or was there like a moment that you're like, you know what, like as much as I love working in the industry here, I know there must be something else. Was that kind of the moment you had? Or
I think you're right. You know, we finished broadcasting school. I went to News Talk ZB and I did my internship there and I loved it. You know, that was still probably my most favorite job I've ever had. I absolutely loved working for News Talk ZB. I loved being a radio journalist. And I, for a while, didn't imagine ever leaving. And then I think just different things happen and you think, well, maybe I could move somewhere else. I think I'd done about 3 years and I was looking at different opportunities. And my boss at the time sort of said, she was considering moving overseas. And I thought, well, I've always wanted to do that. And then someone else. And before I knew it, we had this sort of group of maybe 10 of us that, you know, friends and colleagues that were just all ready to move. And when you start talking to each other and saying, maybe we could move together, it just snowballs, doesn't it? And then, you know, that was kind of it. So I think I had always in the back of my mind wanted to go at some point, but that catalyst was speaking to a few people and realizing that a group of us would go together. And I mean, that was just so exciting to think that we could all move at the same time. So yeah, it's a hard decision to make. And I remember making that phone call to our big boss in the newsroom to tell her that we were all going. But at the same time, I just remember thinking, yeah, it's time to go, new adventure. Let's try something else.
And you touched on the fact that it was a radio that you worked in first. So News Talk ZB, why was it that you went to radio instead of maybe traditional print or anything else? Was there any particular draw for you or was it the opportunity itself, not necessarily radio journalism?
So when I went to broadcasting school, and I'm not sure if you had the same thing, but I had a real vision of what I was going to do. And then 6 months into broadcasting school, it sort of flipped it on its head. I saw how much slower television news was, and I saw how much more impactful radio could be because of the speed of which you're moving. And you work quite independently. You know, you're reporting from the scene, you send a voice note, get a clip on your phone, and then you've got a story and off you go to the next one. I fell in love with it from there. So that was it for me, sort of 6 months into to broadcasting school. I decided that was what I wanted to do. So I kind of pivoted in my focus, and I started doing in the sort of summer holidays that we used to have. I'd go to News Talk ZB or the other radio stations to do your sort of work experience for a week and things like that. So that really just took hold of my imagination. And that's when I decided that I would always, you know, I wanted to stay in radio and work in there. So it was a natural sort of transition. I'm not sure if you had the same, if you kind of at broadcasting school changed your viewpoint on what you wanted to do.
I think that was a combination of a lot of people. I feel like most, like even some of the previous guests that I've had who have gone to broadcasting school or university, they do have their first immediate impressions. And yeah, that was certainly the case with me. I think for me, I was very much under the impression that I was always going to do something more in.
Want to make a difference in your community, but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously. Your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend, or family member, or an organization. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe is backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works, and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
Weirdly, more like on the extremely technical side, and then the longer I did it, the more I was more interested in the content, the producing and things like that, which is eventually what I ended up doing in the UK, which was very far flung from my initial impression. I was always addicted to the whole idea of being in scheduling and doing music and then randomly turned into content, which was really odd because that was my background. So I'm glad you asked that, because I feel like that was the important pivot point for a lot of people, was broadcasting school being like if I hadn't found out about this particular angle or this particular corner of the industry, I never would have gone on. And I feel like that's maybe the important part for a lot of people of going to university or broadcasting schools, not necessarily to learn anything, but to actually figure out what opportunities there really are. And I love how you touched on radio journalism being immediate. Do you feel like situations, because you were in Christchurch probably during the Christchurch earthquake, is that another thing that kind of gave you a little bit of sense of place with how radio journalism can offer immediate kind of coverage of a particular news story? Because radio journalism at that time was probably crucial.
It was, yeah. And I remember, so I was at uni when the Christchurch earthquakes were sort of happening, but I managed to be home for each one of them somehow. You know, I was at uni in Dunedin, but somehow managed to be home for all of them. And you're right, the radio was the one consistent thing that people still had access to. That was how you got information. That's how you knew where you could go to get water in those early hours and things like that. So you're completely right. You've touched on it so well. The connection that radio has with people is so strong. And I think in times of trouble, when everything else is down, that's still something that people can rely on to get information and access. And I know with some of the stories I covered for News Talk ZB, being able to get out there quickly and talk to people, send that information back, you know, to meet the next bulletin, you know, so quickly being on the ground and tell the story to the audience and make sure people were informed so quickly. I loved that. I loved that connection, and I loved that immediacy that radio offers. It's always just been such a such a driver for everything I've done. And, you know, we were talking before we started recording about how you do audio rather than a video podcast. And I love that, because it's such a audio podcast is so connective to other people. You know, the audience feels such a bond with that. And I think audio will always have that stronghold for a lot of people.
Do you think it's also a mixture of trust as well? Because something that I've noticed, particularly in New Zealand, is there is a lot of trust for media, but more so in radio and radio journalism, mm-hmm. like examples being like Radio New Zealand, obviously ZB as well, and Radio Live. Do you think that was also like an added factor as to why you moved into radio journalism, is the fact that when you're out there and about and reporting, not only do you kind of, the connection is from a place of trust as well as also knowing that you have a responsibility. Is that kind of like another facet as to why you kind of dipped into it for a little bit?
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, completely. I think you're right. That connection and that trust factor is huge. And I think, especially in New Zealand, but a lot of countries have connected and trusted radio for a long time. And there's just something about that. It's so inbuilt. You know, we probably all grew up, you know, getting ready for school and hearing some kind of radio on in the background. I know that I remember eating breakfast every morning and hearing the National Radio Bird song. You know, that was that sort of indicator that I needed to finish and get ready and get out the house at that certain time. I think that radio for a lot of us was just there the whole way through. So you do, as you say, have that natural trust and the trust in the media to tell the story accurately. You know, New Zealand's media is so strong still, and certainly the radio, talkback radio, still going strong. You know, there are those people that listen every morning, they ring in. I'm sure you know that with your background. You know, that's a real strong aspect of certain people's lives.
Because it's wild for me even now to think about, because I had a conversation, and I've mentioned this in a previous podcast episode, people still find it weird that the celebrities in our country are radio presenters, radio hosts, journalists, and everything else. And do you think that is a partial reason as to why maybe journalists and radio hosts are so popular and so well respected in New Zealand, is because there is that sense of trust based on that? Or what's your kind of opinion on that?
I think you're right. I think certainly the trust aspect is really strong. And I think because New Zealand is such a small country, you feel very connected to your chosen journalists, your chosen radio or TV station, and you see those people out and about. I guess from my point of view, New Zealand is a country that questions. They're not afraid to ask those questions. We pull, we push, we want to know the truth, maybe more so than other countries. And I think that the journalism side is so strong and so pivotal for people because they're out there asking those questions and really throwing curveballs. And, you know, I'm thinking about some of the sort of talkback radio hosts of the day, and the names have escaped me, which is terrible. But, you know, like Mike Hosking, for example, love him or hate him, my God, he's going to push, and he's not going to stop until he's asked the questions and got some kind of answer. And I remember working on those shows, and it's always a bit of a giggle, isn't it? Because you've got some of those politicians that can't handle it, and then some that can. And again, whatever your political leaning is, when you have those politicians that can take that on and answer the question or not be intimidated or not be pushed around, I always thought, you know, that's such a strength that you have to be able to, you know, and that's what he wants. That's what those kind of radio hosts want. They want that battle. They want that backwards and forwards. And the audience is wanting that too. And then you have the ones that can't handle it. They hang up, they get upset. And, you know, talkback radio and journalism as a whole is not for everyone, but certainly it separates it separates from the men from the boys, I think.
I think you hit the nail on the head, and it's certainly, like, I think anyone who's done their time in media always loves a bit of a battle of the bastard sort of scenario, and hearing like two really hard-nosed, one a host or a really gnarly politician, going at each other. There's nothing more enjoyable, because it kind of is. It's like punching, taking jabs and everything else in between. Is there any particular interview from your time working at News Talk ZB, whether it be from the political sphere or from anything else, that you felt really encapsulated that in that way of like something that was a bit of a battle of the wits?
Battle of the wits, definitely. I think I do remember the afternoons when Mike Hosking would be on, and around the election time, and I remember certain politicians, you know, their press secs would ring in early and sort of want the questions, want the topics. And, you know, sometimes the office would refuse, or they'd say, look, we're going to touch on these things, but we're not telling you the questions. You know, this is what it's going to be about. And you'd have press secs desperately trying to get more information. And then others that would sort of say, okay, all right, he'll be there. You know, or she'll be there, that's fine. And just seeing the different approaches and then the level of preparation that some of those politicians needed to be able to take someone like that on versus those who could get on there and just say, look, okay, this is what I'm trying to say. You know, let me speak. And yes, you say that battle of the wits going backwards and forwards. But I always really respected those that sort of went into those battles prepared, but not trying to push an agenda, just ready for whatever was going to come. So that certainly sticks with me. And then I think of Chris Lynch being on the sort of the morning talk back as well. And hearing, he was always so good at balancing those crazy people that would ring in with those, all, you know, really bizarre opinions or different opinions. And they would go through, because, you know, it sounds great, doesn't it, on the radio to have a bit of diversity and a bit of something different. And you'd put them through to him, and he would deal with them so well. And he'd really push them to the nth degree to try and explain their opinion. And a lot of them couldn't. And you sort of hear that and think, you know, those mornings would stick with me, where you're listening in, waiting to see if people would snap or if they could explain themselves properly or hang up in the end. So talkback radio, my gosh, doesn't it just bring the most bizarre people together? But it certainly shows you, you know, who can do what and where your skill set is.
I do think it's still one of the finest bastions. I think some people I know who work in radio would argue that and say it's a cesspit of people that just want to like talk over each other. But I personally feel like it's been the most enjoyable experiences I've had have always been working in talkback or being around that sort of sphere. I even did it in London. So I got to see both sides of New Zealand and the UK weirdos. And I will say the UK, they do a fine job of it. I worked for one that was a bit more right wing leaning, which is a little bit opposite to what I'm on in terms of the spectrum, but oh mate, yeah, you got to hear some pretty dual sort of calls every now and then, and the host as well, you know. But yes. I think it's a nice part of the industry, because I feel like you're right, it does kind of have its own weight of gold in terms of like, yeah, showing every side, every aspect and everything else in between. So yeah. You had that moment, you bunched together with about 10 of yous where you're like, we're looking at moving to the UK. You made that move. How was it for you when you first landed in the UK? Was it scary? Did you find it intimidating? Or did you feel like it was right at home? You were back at home. You felt comfortable. You were ready to hit the industry hard. What was your general feeling when you landed?
Well, it's a very good question. I think when I landed, I was nervous, but I really did feel like I'd sort of come home in a way. I knew how the tube worked. I knew how different systems worked. It didn't feel as overwhelming as it would moving to a different country. I think, you know, in New Zealand and London, well, the UK are quite similar. So, you know, you don't have any language barriers or anything like that. You're very lucky. But I think getting into London, I just sort of felt like I'd come home and I was where I wanted to be. And I wanted to sort of find my feet. Finding a job there was a bit different. My first job was actually managing an Australian cafe. It was the first job I could get to pay the bills. So we all kind of slept on different couches for the first 3 months. I'm sure maybe you had the same experience. You're looking for a flat, but you don't have the deposit money. So you're couch surfing for a couple of months while you find an apartment, find a job. That first 3 months, I remember ringing home every week and sort of saying, what have I done? I'm working sort of 80 hours a week at this horrible cafe. You know, I'm sleeping in this awful bedsit kind of room. Like, this is ridiculous. But knowing that you just kind of keep going, don't you? Because it's going to get better. And on the bad days, you could still look out and you're in London and it's still so exciting. And then eventually you find your feet and it all kind of comes together. But I think it's a rite of passage for a lot of people. I don't know if you had the same experience.
I think you hit the nail on the head. It's a rite of passage. I think you need to be humbled by London. It needs to beat you down. And then you need to have that moment of being like, I finally made it. I feel like if you go in there like head first and everything goes fine, you haven't really experienced London. It's kind of like people that say you haven't lived in New York until you've hated being in New York. And I feel like that's kind of the deal with London. And out of curiosity, do you remember the name of the cafe that you worked at and what area it was in?
Oh, so I was in Chiswick. So the area was really nice. Oh.
I used to live in Chiswick as well. Very nice. That was where I first landed as well. And then I realized how expensive it was. And I was like, I'm no longer living in Chiswick.
Exactly. The cafe, God, what was it called? I can't remember, but it was a sort of Australasian. It was Brew. It was called Brew.
I think I've heard of it. Nice. Very good.
Yeah. So I ended up, I just got some shifts working there and then the manager walked out, which should have been the first, you know, red flag for me. But anyway, the next day I had the job managing the cafe and I'd get one day off every 3 weeks and I would work from dusk till dawn, crazy hours as you do. And that was, my first experience, but I got out of there as quickly as I could.
So sustaining yourself from flat whites and pastries basically for that like the 3 week period basically at a time. Oh, geez, that's rough. Yeah, I feel you.
I never bought groceries, I have to say, in that sort of 2 months of working there. So at least I saved money that way.
Oh, mate, I sympathise with you. I'm not even sure if I should readily admit this on air, but I pretended to be a builder. So I was a labourer on job sites and I said that I had a permit to work. And so that's what I got to get work basically when I was in London because I just couldn't get a job. I tried to like everything. Yeah. So I was on job sites the majority of the time. I probably shouldn't have been there. So thank you to the recruitment agency that hired me over there. Oh, and I did gardening work as well. Gardening in West London. It was lovely, you know. Got to make a buck. So, you know, I'm glad we went through similar experiences. And I think I had the same thing as you. Like the manager kind of left at one point and I was like, what the hell am I doing here? Like I need to get the hell out. And so
I love it. It's such a UK thing that you just say you have a permit to work and they're like, okay, off you go.
Yeah, that's fair enough. But I think that's kind of a mix of probably, and you probably had a bit of this as well. It's the Kiwi attitude in a sense of being like, I might not know how to do this, but bugger it, I'll give it a go and see what happens.
Yes, and I think that they prioritise, when you get to the UK and you're Kiwi or Australian, they really prioritise our kind of work ethic. And I think that was the first time realising when I moved that we have this sort of reputation as being really hard workers. And that follows you everywhere. And I'm sure you've had that in, you know, moving to Argentina and things like that. They do actually want to hire you because they know that whether maybe you have the skill set or not, you will do the hard yards. And that's certainly a Kiwi thing. And yeah, I'm really proud to be able to actually have that. But you don't realize it until you move overseas and you see different work ethics as well. And you realize that actually we're quite unique.
And was it quite hard for you as well, like getting into that first role to cut your teeth in the UK? Because I've had the same chat with other people who have said like getting that first role, especially in media in the UK, can sometimes be the hardest thing. But once you've got it, you've got it. And like you're going to be able to like go flying into any other role afterwards. How was it for you getting that first media role, like working as a journalist or just working? Because I think you worked in radio was your first role in the UK, was it not?
Yes, it was. So I would do, I worked for Radio Essex or an Essex-based radio station, and I would do that over the weekends. So I'd do sort of nights and weekends, and I'd take the train all the way out there and do all of their bulletins and recordings and things like that. And that was sort of a side hustle, I guess, a side job. But getting that and then also getting the role at LexisNexis, where as a journalist there, was the sort of, as you say, that pivotal point. Once you had that and you had sort of something on your CV that was UK-based but corporate, it just gave you a bit more, it gave you a bit more standing to be able to move from there. You're right. And it was hard, really hard, as most people say, to get those roles. But as soon as you had them, then you were just kind of part of that movement of people that were working in a more corporate media environment. And then from there, you could launch on. But I remember going to all sorts of different interviews and phoning and, you know, sending your CV and your sort of mixtape of your reel. That's what I'm looking for. I remember sending all these emails and my reel from New Zealand to all these different media companies and them saying, yeah, thanks, but no thanks, or not coming back, and thinking, well, what else am I going to do? From my point of view, I'm trying my hardest. I didn't know what else to do apart from door knock. But once you do get that first opportunity, then it's that launch pad into actually being able to live and exist and survive properly.
And like at any point during that process of doing the applications, were you ever thinking like, should I just stop and do something else? What was going through your mind? Were you reaching that point? Were you close to getting to that point? Or was it, no, Charlotte has always, like, I'm always going to be on the ball. I'm always going to keep going for it no matter what. Was
Want to make a difference in your community but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously, your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend, or family member, or an organization. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe is backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works, and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
Was there stubbornness? Kind of what was the process for you there?
Definitely stubbornness. I am actually a very stubborn person, so that definitely fueled me. I think there's nothing like the pressure of needing to pay your bills to actually force you forward. And I think having those moments where you look around and you know that you have to make something work, whatever that is, something is going to have to change and work so that you can continue and move forward. So I always had that in the back of my mind. That was always the drive. You know, that was why I would get up at crazy o'clock and get three trains to Essex to do a shift to make it work, however it was going to. And that was always instilled in me very early on from my mum. I'm very lucky to have that. But I did have a good support system as well. You know, I had her and friends that you could lean on to sort of cry on at night when it wasn't working, and they'd say, you know, keep going, you know, keep pushing. And eventually it all kind of come to fruition. I did have those moments, I'm sure a lot of people do, where you look at your skill set and you try and work out, maybe if it's not going to be journalism, where else can I go? What else can I do? I think that's why a lot of people move into marketing, PR, comms. It also does make you look at your skill set in a different way, which is not a bad thing at all. It actually makes you reassess how you could be working in different sort of areas and in different ways. And I think there's actually something to be said for reworking your sort of skill set that way.
Because you did that when you moved into LexisNexis, because you mentioned that you were working as a journalist for them, which LexisNexis, for anyone who doesn't know, they're a data analytics company, like providing like basically information for the legal sector, mostly, if I'm not mistaken. And so was that kind of like a like when you talk about compartmentalizing and thinking about what your experiences are, is that kind of like why you were like, you know what, I should give LexisNexis a go because I know I still have these skill sets, but I can bring it to the corporate world in a different fashion? Is that why you kind of went down that track, or was it cropped up just at the right place, right time?
I think it was more, it cropped up. I had a friend that I'd worked with in New Zealand, and she got a job with LexisNexis, and I was still at the cafe, and she got me a couple of shifts, you know. And your network, God, isn't your network so important? Whatever country you move to, that's how, you know, you often get these opportunities. So I was very lucky that Jess got me a couple of shifts there, and then I did more and more, and then they needed help. And so that was my kind of chance to move into that team full-time as a full-time freelancer for a year. So I didn't have a full-time role, but I worked sort of 50 hours a week, 40 hours a week still for them. But I think it was the next step, because from there I was trying to work out what I wanted to do next, and moving into actually RSM, where I did their sort of content creation and communications, that was the pivot I think you're talking about, for looking at my skill set and realizing that you could go different ways. Coincidentally, the LexisNexis building was basically one across from the RSM building. There was a pub in between. It was on the same street, which is just crazy. But that was that moment where I thought, well, this job had come up and I'd been offered to apply. And you think, well, maybe that corporate sector, maybe moving into something like that might be a really good stepping stone, and I can try and use my skills in different ways. And let's just see what this opportunity gives. So that was that moment where I moved away from the journalism side and into more content writing, and sort of went into the dark side of communications.
Which you talk about the dark side of communications, but I feel like naturally journalists at some point will look at it and consider it, because, well, one, the corporate money is always good, but two, the corporate side of things can be interesting, because it's about providing spin. It's a mix of everything. It's a mix of marketing, news, and all the other cuts. But the thing I'd be interested to talk about, how important do you feel the pub is in relation to networking yourself, especially in the UK? Is that something that you experience, that a lot of the real business dealings go down in a pub over a pint?
100%. And some friends and I were talking about this over the weekend. It's so different now. I know post-COVID it's very different, but you're right. You know, the pub is such a focal point for everything. I remember doing my one-on-ones in the pub. You know, the partners walking through the office and saying, if everyone gets work done by 3, we're going. And that's how you write. You networked, you met people, job opportunities came up by being in the pub, which I suppose for like a younger generation now, hearing that must seem crazy. But yeah, in London, everything is done around that kind of central space, and you're always at the same pub. And that's how you meet other people and build your network and everything like that. So that's how I very much found it. And that's how I got different opportunities as well. Did you find the same thing with that sort of pub culture?
100%. But I'd be curious, what was the go-to one for you guys? Because I was in Soho. So whereabouts were you?
So we were just up from London Bridge. So we had a pub called Harold's, and both jobs, I went to Harold's. So yeah, that was the pub in between the two buildings that I worked in.
Oh, that is brilliant. I love that.
So that was the pivotal pub for me.
Also, we should reiterate that me and Charlotte are not saying that we go to the pub for every business consulting or any sort of business that we're running, but it was just when we're in the UK. Yeah, I think a lot of younger people now would think it's absolutely mental that was kind of where, because it's obviously deviated away from that. I think the longer I look back at London and like the culture that kind of existed, particularly in media, I feel like it's completely changed now. It's not ever going to be the same. I feel like our generation was maybe the last generation where there was like business dealings in the pub, and maybe like a lot of the real talk going down there, which is kind of strange to think about.
I know, but I think you're right. I think it all changed after COVID, and then that new generation coming in. I know with my teams in London after COVID, trying to get them out to go for a drink to celebrate something, they didn't want to go. You know, everyone's different, but I just think that it wasn't even really a choice for us. It was, you know, that was where you cut your teeth. If you could go to the pub on a Thursday night and still come into work for 8 o'clock on a Friday morning, then everyone deemed that you were sort of worthwhile. They wanted to give you, better opportunities and things like that. That's how you proved part of your worth, I think, by being able to do that and connect with different people. Whereas now, I suppose we'll work from home as well. So, you know, if you're going out on a Thursday night, the Friday morning isn't so tricky. But yeah, it's a very different approach now to what we sort of went through back in our day.
I think it's almost like a sort of social hazing in a sense as well. I certainly know for one role that I worked in, I definitely know I wouldn't have got my contract extended if I hadn't have gone to the pub and met the manager who I think actually pulled me out of work at maybe 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and I was meant to be working till 7. And he's like, no, you coming out with me. And then he said, lie to your coworker and say that you're going off sick. And then the same coworker ended up arriving at the pub at about 7:30. He's like, so, what are you going to say to him? And it was kind of like a testing sort of thing. I feel like that's a bit of it as well.
Real hazing.
Odd scenarios. And I'm glad you kind of had a similar experience in terms of like, yeah, seeing the kind of dark side of media. Well, not the dark side. It was always enjoyable. There was nothing wrong with it. But, you know, it is strange to think about like that now, because I'm sure in Singapore that is not the culture.
No, absolutely not. I mean, exactly. Even, you know, aside from the fact that alcohol in Singapore is incredibly expensive, it's just, it's not the way of the world anymore. And I don't even think London is so much like that. I think it's really changed. But do you have that kind of culture in Argentina at all, or is that quite different?
Well, that's the weird thing. It is, but it isn't. So drinking is not, they don't have the drinking culture of like the UK or probably even New Zealand in that sense. It's much more relaxed, but any sort of business needs to be done on a personal level, anything at all. Like, you cannot do business with anyone if they don't have some sort of friendship or social network. And that it can be anything from going out for a coffee with someone or going out to lunch or going out to dinner or something like that. There needs to be a social aspect with any business. Otherwise, no one will take you seriously. It's odd, but it's something I've grown accustomed to and I actually quite like. It's kind of, it makes everything far more friendly and it's far more trusting when you feel like someone's willing to meet you in person to kind of discuss things. So there's no, it's almost like no shadiness involved with anything. So I think the only other way I can describe it is I worked remotely for this company for 5 years, and it wasn't until maybe a month ago I ended up meeting my boss in person. But every week we would talk for about 4 hours, not even about the work, just about personal life. So it's an odd kind of dynamic that you do get here, which I feel like it's probably a lot more serious, a lot more business oriented.
It is in a way, but the personal connection is still really important. You're right. And I think Singapore is so small that, you know, everyone knows each other or knows sort of someone who knows someone. So networking here is really important. And that's sort of how you build anything. If you don't have, similar to what you were saying, if you don't have that network, less probably friendship, but if you don't have that network, you're not going to get anywhere here. And that's how you kind of develop any kind of business or relationship. And they do really appreciate those still meeting in person. I think they don't actually, certainly here, and maybe it is also post-COVID, but a lot of people want to meet up in person rather than have a call. They want to see you, they want to meet you, and that's how they'll make their decision, which I appreciate. And actually, as you say, I quite like building relationships that way, because meeting someone for a coffee, shaking their hand, seeing them in an environment as opposed to just on a sort of 20-minute call, you really get to know them, I think, so much better. And it's certainly more authentic to making a decision of whether to work together or not, as opposed to just, you know, email or a quick call.
Because you worked in the corporate world, as you were mentioning before, you made that shift to the dark side of PR, media, comms, and it must be interesting, because you're probably coming in at a point where, like, you were there before the COVID quarantine, or you were coming to the tail end of, the starting point of that kind of area. What was it like for you working corporate comms at that point? Because working for, was it RSM, you must have been in a completely different environment. You're writing content that you're obviously having to try and make interesting from the corporate side of things. Did you like that challenge at first, or was it really difficult? How did you find moving from that completely different wheelhouse?
In the beginning, as you say, I did enjoy the challenge of trying to make that content and that copy interesting, and that sort of lifting the lid of what accountancy and partnerships and things like that is all about. I think very quickly I realized that job probably wasn't for me. It was also a difficult place to work for a number of reasons, but I'd have to say my co-workers were my saving grace there. We had an incredibly tight team, and I think, you know, nothing bonds you stronger than a bit of work trauma. But working there, I certainly learned a lot of skills, and I learned a lot about, you know, accountancy, money, all of those sorts of things. But I also learned a lot about people management, because you're dealing with, you know, partners and different levels, seniority, a lot of egos. So I'd have to say that the skills that I learned there, whilst not particularly around the copywriting, were really useful in moving into the next role, which was all about sort of client management. But I think after a while, I was so bored in that role, which is why I moved into podcasting, because on the side, I basically pitch to the RSM board to get to try and get some budget to create a podcast, which we did. And the podcast was all about lifting the lid on partners and who they were and learning a bit more about them. And that was my saving grace because it was a creative project. I could write, I could work in audio again, I could do all of those things that I loved under that umbrella. And that was really the saving grace, I think, for my sanity, being able to create that podcast at RSM. I thank that job for giving me that lift and that movement into podcasting, but I think it certainly wasn't somewhere that I was wanting. I didn't want to stay. It wasn't for me in the end.
In terms of RSM, you talked about trauma as well. Was that more related to the senior management that you were working with or more or less the work that you're doing? Because I know, especially in corporate comms, it can be particularly difficult because you have the KPIs and things that always people are going to be taking notice of, particularly with, I know, for example, a lot of people that work in startup media comms and things like that, and there's constant pressure on KPIs. Oh, how many likes, how many follows do our posts have on Instagram? Or how come we're not seeing conversion based on like how many likes we have on this post? Where was the trauma coming from? Was it from senior management or was it just from the work itself was just not fulfilling in any sense?
I think the work wasn't particularly fulfilling. You're right. I didn't find that was my calling. It wasn't where I wanted to be. But there was a lot of systemic issues within the organization, senior management, things like that. And that just bled into everything. So it didn't really matter what you did. There was always that sort of dark cloud of difficulty and pressure. And you know, it's hard when you work in teams and people are disappearing left, right and center because they've been let go, not foster a particularly supportive and kind environment. But it did mean that I have created some sort of best friends along the way from working there because, as I said, nothing bonds you more than that kind of toxic work culture. So you definitely get something out of it. But I think it was a mixture of everything. And as you say, the work just wasn't fulfilling. It wasn't what I wanted to do or envisioned I would do with my life. And so it was definitely something that it was a springboard, but it was time when I left, it was time to go.
Was it also a teachable moment in the sense of like having a better understanding of what kind of companies you didn't want to work for? I think that's something I've noticed with a lot of people is sometimes they do need to have that traumatic experience. And I know that sounds really terrible. It's like people saying, oh, you need to get bullied at school in order for you to strive for what you want. Like, you know, like that classic opinion that people seem to throw around. Like back in my day, people got hassled because then it gave them the drive to do something successful. Was that like, but do you feel like going into that company kind of gave you a better idea of like, this is certainly where I want to be. This is where I don't want to be.
Yes, it's a really good point you made. Absolutely. It definitely showed me what I didn't want. I didn't want to be in that industry. I didn't want to be doing that kind of job. And I didn't want to be trying to put a creative spin on something that really you can only do so much with in a company where people don't want to see change. So it was a really good lesson in how far I wanted to go and what I didn't want to do. And then it really influenced the rest of my career decisions, while also actually giving you those kind of corporate understanding, the skill set, being able to communicate with people in that kind of corporate setting. As you say, it's very different coming from the media to that. I was so used to working to deadlines, but working in a creative way where people weren't questioning everything you did, and being able to create a story and use some kind of creativity. And then I'm sure you felt the same. You move into sort of corporate PR and you think, oh my God, and 700 people have to check everything all the time. And there's processes upon processes and all of that kind of thing. So learning to navigate that is important, but it also teaches you that maybe it's not right. It wasn't right for me.
I can completely understand the whole idea of going from the CMO to the assistant to the coordinator to the then to the that to the that to the that. It's like it's all very much a process, a tower of constant approvals for maybe a piece of
Want to make a difference in your community but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously, your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend, or family member, or an organization. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe is backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works, and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
copy that you wrote in maybe an hour and then won't see the light of day for another 4 weeks until it's gone through all of the layers of the company. And also you've got to make sure that the messaging is correct as well. And is it on brand? No, it needs to go back to you, Charlotte, before it can get proved again. Yeah, I can completely understand that. Yeah, it's an interesting experience switching to that. And I think it's good that you kind of came to that realization that that wasn't where you wanted to be. So what drew you into podcasting initially? Because you'd already done the corporate side of things, you'd done a little bit of a test run on podcasting, but then you decided to move into it more aggressively working for 4DC. What was the kind of reason that you decided to go full deep into podcasting? Was there any particular reason, or was it more or less you realized this was an avenue that you could see yourself working in full time?
Yeah, I think podcasting was sort of taking hold, and I was definitely really getting into it, especially a lot of the true crime podcasts, and it really moved fast in the UK, and suddenly everyone was listening to them. And I think creating that podcast for RSM was really that catalyst for me remembering and being able to find those journalistic skills again, the writing, the technical side, the audio, bringing people together. And I loved being able to basically create radio content again, but in a more packaged form. And it really spoke to me. So it was something that I'd started to love doing on the side. And the 4DC role came up to basically start a podcasting team, sort of boutique consulting and everything. And I remember when I met with the founders, what they were talking about wasn't just creating a podcast, but it was this whole idea of strategy and sort of consultancy. And I hadn't heard of anything like that before. I didn't realize that that was something that you could do. And understanding that there was all of this work to be done at the beginning to create such an amazing podcast, how it all came together, just really spoke to me. And I loved the idea of being able to do that. So it felt like a really natural shift and going back to my roots in a way of journalism and things like that. And it felt like a really natural kind of segue in terms of what I wanted to do with my career and where I wanted to be, getting back into that creative media side. It really just, yeah, it absolutely spoke to me. So that role and that role was so pivotal into understanding podcasting, and then seeing it from a branded side was just fantastic to learn so much through that. And, you know, I took that job, and then a month later, COVID happened and everything shut down, and, you know, podcasting just shot through the roof at that stage. It was so different.
It was almost like the best thing that could have happened to you. I know this sounds really terrible, but was it almost the best thing that could have happened to you at that time, realizing that you have hit the nail, like you're working in an industry now that is like the hottest thing at the time?
Yeah, I think it was. It was such a key move to basically creating a completely different career. And as you say, everyone, when COVID hit, I think so many companies and entrepreneurs and people realized that they needed a way to connect with an audience, and they suddenly couldn't just use their normal routes. They needed something different, and everyone had budget. COVID allowed everyone to be able to actually spend in different ways. So I think within that first sort of 6 months of starting that job, we had so many different corporate clients sort of come out of the woodwork and suddenly want to look into podcasting. And I loved the ability to work with all of these really big brands and actually talk to them about pivoting and changing the way that they looked at content, rather than writing and speaking and saying what they wanted to do, doing, you know, your usual corporate stuff. Podcasting had to be done in an authentic and original way, and you had to create something so much deeper for them if it was going to land and if it was going to resonate. So it was a way of basically educating brands, and it still is, educating brands and people to understand that podcasting isn't about just getting a message across. It's so much deeper than that, and it's so much more authentic. And I think that's why it's such a powerful medium. And great to work in.
And what were some of the brands that you ended up working for, Charlotte, during that time at 4DC? What were some of the more notable ones that you ended up consulting for?
So we did a whole range, and we worked sort of globally. So it was a lot was in Dubai and a lot in the UK and Europe, but then we did in Asia as well. So we worked with Unilever, MasterCard, Visa, GSK, Philips. I was the host of Philips' internal podcast at one stage. So we worked with all these huge brands, and that was where I started to understand that the client management side as well, and develop those skills. And I think that's what I've been able to take into my business now. But working for those big clients and those big organizations, you understand the processes and you understand how they work, and also how you can bring the best of them to light. telling these huge brands that no one wants to listen to their corporate podcast is tough, but it's true because no one does. The whole point of what I was doing was to actually bring that content to life and create content that the audience wanted to listen to and would connect with. And then it comes back to, you know, ticking off, as you say, the KPIs and actually being worthwhile for them. But it takes a little while to get used to the fact that you're sitting in these meetings and sort of saying, look, guys, this is not going to work. You can't do it this way. We've got to change. But it's pretty exhilarating as well.
What do you think was one of the more, I guess, interesting pivots that you took with a branded podcast? Because, yeah, to add context, in case anyone's kind of wanting to understand the idea behind branded podcasts usually come from a brand's wanting to either, yeah, basically put out their own identity that's not necessarily just talking about their product or their business, or maybe it's finding an interesting way to talk about their business or their product without just shoving it down your throat. Let's take, for example, Philips, not just talking about maybe, I don't know, the greatest new electric shaver that they have. Maybe it's like a lifestyle podcast that somehow is able to manage to relate back to maybe an interesting product that they have. What do you think was one of the more interesting pivots that you took with a brand?
Oh, I think one of the ones that stands out to me is Unilever. So we created two different internal podcasts for Unilever. And that was incredible because I think in COVID, they realized, obviously, their staff is like 200,000 people or something worldwide. It's nuts. And they realized that their staff weren't connected at all to the business, to sort of senior management, and they were having a real disconnect problem. And so what they wanted to do was create a podcast to bring people back together. But the corporate messaging wasn't going to work there. So we did a lot of work and a lot of kind of strategy sessions at the beginning to understand what they wanted to do, and then also what people internally wanted to listen to. And that was really interesting to sort of pull those two together. And we ended up using that. Unilever had all these amazing videos of their different senior leadership teams talking about failure, problems they'd had, you know, the biggest messes they'd ever made in their lives, all these things that were actually really authentic and really kind of gritty. And we took loads of that and cut it up, and then we re-recorded bits, and we actually were able to make a really creative product from that, which spoke to people about it was okay to fail. It was okay to not know what to do with your life. Bringing people together through that kind of content, they could listen to it whenever they wanted. It actually had a huge impact. And I know it was one of the most sort of listened and watched videos that we ever created for them. But it really had an impact for people. And it was amazing to actually see that different side of a brand and different side of senior leaders talking about all sorts of things you'd never think that they would. And so it just went to show that by taking a slightly different approach for a big corporate, you could actually create something really long lasting and meaningful that would have impact, as opposed to just the same stuff you hear every time.
Do you think that's also maybe a common mistake that a lot of corporations make when they're trying to do internal comms and internal media, is they don't really consider what people actually want to listen to or what they're actually going to find interesting? And do you feel like podcasts are the vehicle for that? Like, do you see podcasts as becoming a more common way for a lot of companies, especially of that size, to be able to communicate with their employees? Or do you see it maybe it's just a trendy thing for 5 years and maybe it'll die off? What do you envision is going to be like the future of internal comms, particularly in podcasting?
Internal comms is really interesting, isn't it? I think podcasting is kind of the future of internal comms. And I think if you look at any of the stats and the research that's come out in the last few years, people want to engage with their company. They feel disengaged. They don't feel like they're listened to, but they don't want another talking heads video. They don't want another town hall or a newsletter. What they want is active communication. And the stats show that they would be very open to a podcast. So by creating something like that as a corporation or as an organization, as opposed to just another newsletter, another thing that people will disregard, podcasting actually allows you to connect with people. It allows you to open yourself up. It also allows your internal audience to actually feel connected with the company. And you can feature different people, you know, bring everything to life. So I think for internal comms, podcasting is a really powerful tool. And I think it's something that more and more companies should look at. It's moving. I think you've definitely got companies that are looking into it. And, you know, some of my clients are doing it now. But I think it's a really underutilized tool for, you know, internal communications. Internal communications is really tricky. You know, most people don't want to listen or watch or do. But by creating something for them, I think that's how you know, re-engage your workforce.
Are you seeing like a common trend? Because this is a conversation I had with a friend of mine who works in marketing, that you're seeing a lot of companies are trying to tackle this on their own by putting in already overstretched staff working in marketing to try and handle things like putting together a podcast, a social media campaign. Do you think companies need to take into account more often that they should be hiring exclusive professionals, like, for example, your company or other companies, to actually handle this rather than just trying to see if they can lump it on another social media manager who's poorly already being stretched to the max? Do you feel like that's something that companies should be taking into account?
not to toot my own horn or, you know, push people into hiring people like myself, but I think it's really important when it comes to things like podcasting to outsource it. I think you need people in the industry that are experts, that understand the medium, understand audiences, trends, everything that's going on, because it's a really fluid, really fast moving environment. And I think, as you say, when you lump your marketing manager or someone in comms with this task, it's never going to be as effective as when you kind of bring in professionals to do this for you. And I think also with podcasting, people have moved past this, you know, just the basic recording. People are looking for so much more because there's so much amazing content out there. You need it to be accessible. You need it to be well done and well thought through. And the only way that you can do that is by using professionals to really create that magic. You know, a lot of the work that I see clients don't do, you know, the big brands and even entrepreneurs as well, they don't do all that pre-prep, that work that I do, the strategy, audience understanding, success measurement. All of that sort of feeds into creating a fantastic podcast. But if you ignore all of that, you're just another company putting more content out there for it to be disregarded.
And going back to strategy as well, do you think almost having a bit of a strategy before even speaking to someone like yourself or a consultancy company is also like advised? Because I think this is another mistake that maybe companies make, and not only in podcasting, but like social media marketing, anything else in the corporate world, is that they just think, because everyone else is doing it, I'm going to do it too. Do you think that comes down to a big part of it as well, that companies need to actually consider, is this worth me like putting into my strategy, or am I just doing it because I'm seeing something shiny and think it's worth doing myself?
You've hit the nail on the head completely. So many companies want a podcast because everybody else is having one. And when you actually ask them the question, what do you want to achieve with this? Why do you want it? They don't always have the right answer. And I have no problem working with someone and saying to them, look, I don't think you should make a podcast because it's time consuming. It's expensive. It's not for everyone. Sometimes it's better to just do some social media ads and move on. You know, not everyone should have a podcast. If you want one and you think that you want to take it to fruition, you need to put time and effort into understanding the medium and also understanding your audience so that you create content that they actually find and engage with. So I think you're right. Some people don't need a podcast. The world doesn't always need another corporate podcast.
Yeah, but they always do need another guy who's white, bald, talking into a microphone again, like myself. But yeah, so in terms of some of the other things that I find really interesting as well is, do you think another common pitfall that people find themselves in is thinking, because I am maybe the front-facing person of the company, I should be the person hosting the podcast? You find it's a common pitfall that you find companies are trying to push, maybe, I don't know, the CEO or founder of the company who is probably one of the worst public speakers ever or isn't a good representation of the company. Do you find that something that you are constantly finding yourself encountering?
Oh my gosh, all the time. Yes. So striking that so many people have this issue. You're right. To be a podcast host or even a podcast guest, that is a skill. It takes a lot. People do it professionally for a reason. I train people to be podcast hosts for a reason. So just because you are the CEO or the CFO of a company, it does not mean that you will be great on camera or great recording. And it doesn't mean that you can carry the conversation. I worked with a company last week and, you know, initially when they signed on, I said, let's do some work. Let's find you a host, all these things. Nope. We don't want scripting. We don't want support. And we've got our own host. So I spent 3 hours sitting in the studio with them coaxing this host through the recording, and it was so painful, and they're not happy, and they're now going right back to the beginning and they have to start again. I don't understand why a company would look at that and think that, you know, let's just bring in old Bob from next door. He'll be great at, you know, facilitating this conversation. A podcast host needs to not only facilitate the conversation, but be listening to the, you know, like you're doing with me, listen to the guest, allow the conversation to flow, jump on little bits here and there to, you know, create more of a conversation. You know, you're doing it yourself and doing an amazing job, but you must know that it's not the easiest thing in the world. People train for this. So yes, it's a conversation I have often with a lot of comfort. Just because someone thinks that they could be the podcast host, they may not necessarily be the best one.
I'm glad that you say this because I feel like I've had a lot of people. It's like the classic saying. I'm guessing you had this probably in radio where you had friends of yours being like, you know, I know how to talk shit. Oh, you're going to be great on radio. I'd be a fantastic host, you know. You've seen me having a yarn, you know. It's all fine. It's good. And one thing I'm really keen to kind of dip into as well is the fact that you're a massive advocate for niche podcasting, which I love because I think it's something that I feel a lot of people seem to neglect, that sometimes the people who are the best about speaking about any sort of subject matter are the people that are the most passionate about it. And do you find that's also a really good way for people to be able to understand maybe where their kind of angle should be? that they should be niching down, and but they should also be passionate about what they're talking about or the content that they're creating.
Yes, absolutely. Passion is so key, I think, to creating really engaging content. But niche podcasting is so powerful. I always say it, and I run a masterclass on podcasting here in Singapore every couple of months. And the big thing that I try to point out is that not everyone can be Stephen Bartlett. You know, he's created something amazing, but you don't necessarily want 1,000 sort of views or listens on your podcast if it's not going to lead to anything. You'd rather have 100 or 50 engaged people that listen to the whole thing, and then maybe click on your website or whatever, you know, you're trying to achieve with that content. The whole point is to have an engaged audience, and the numbers shouldn't matter so much.
Want to make a difference in your community but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously, your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend, or family member, or an organization. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe is backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works, and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
It's about what that audience does and how much they sort of bond with the content that you're creating. And niche podcasting is so much more powerful. You know, there's, what is there, X amount of million podcasts out there. So if you go niche and you're passionate, I think that's the drive to creating really effective content, as opposed to top line, trying to do everything. The niche podcasts are the sort of the way of the future, and certainly for success of content.
Is this another thing that you find yourself kind of regularly having to kind of educate people on? Because I love the fact that you talk about the idea of, like, who is your listener? What is the listener? What are they wanting to achieve out of this? Is it a common thing that you're finding you're educating a lot of people that are clients of yours who are saying, why has my podcast not got tens of thousands of listens? Like, I want 10,000 listeners. That's the people that's going to buy. Is it kind of funny for you when you explain to them, like, you actually would prefer to have 50 listeners and 10 that are going to buy than having 10,000 and no one actually gives a shit and is probably going to not click on your website or not even look at what you're doing? Is that kind of like a fun educational thing for you, having to like be like, trust me, you want the smaller numbers. The smaller numbers are good.
I don't know if I would use the word fun, but you are completely correct. And I think it's definitely a mind shift thing. You know, people, traditional media and traditional advertising and things like that, you get it. Your ROI is ticked off, isn't it? You know what you're getting. You pay for what you get. Podcasting is difficult to get your head around the fact that you're delving into something that you may not get exactly what you want back. But one of the biggest things that I always push for is consistency. You know, you have to be consistent with what you're doing as a podcast creator. Podcast audiences are incredibly loyal, but they want you to be putting your podcast out every Tuesday or, you know, every second week or whatever you're doing. And you have to go beyond 3 or 4 episodes. You often have to go beyond 3 or 4 seasons to really land it and really land your audience. You will know yourself. Unfortunately, you just have to keep going. There's a statistic out there, and I think it's like 3% of all the world's podcasts have got beyond 10 episodes because people give up so quickly, because it's time consuming, because it's expensive, and they haven't seen the 10,000 downloads, so they give up. So you have to keep going with podcasting, and you have to just be consistent in what you're doing, and they will eventually come. And whether it is, as you say, the 10, you know, really engaged listeners who click your website and buy your product, that's brilliant. Or whether you're pushing for the 10,000 downloads, consistency is one of the key things or key ways to get there.
And also, I was curious, is format a big kind of factor in terms of how you consult a lot of your clients? Because I know that the classic podcast format for a lot of people is the interview podcast or two, but do you find yourself occasionally recommending people to go into different styles or different formats or different modes compared to maybe what they traditionally feel is like the classic podcast format?
Yes, exactly. I think that's such an interesting point because the interview kind of style is great, but it doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to be perfect for your topic or your genre of podcasting. There's so many different ways to do it, whether you've got round table, whether you're going for more of a narrative storytelling approach. There are lots of different things you can do. So I think it's really important to do that research and look at trends and what's landing with the right audiences that you want to reach. And that will help inform the way that you can format your podcast. And it allows you to be so much more creative as well, rather than, you know, know, just as you say, two people sitting down and having a conversation, there are sometimes different ways that you can be more creative to bring that content alive.
And I feel like we have to make the final pivot, your final moving point, which is where you are now. You're in Singapore, you're still working in podcasting, you're running your own business, CLW Media, which, how do you feel about moving into being your own businesswoman? Like, how did you feel from going? Because I think a lot of people will always prefer the safety net of being in a company. I certainly know I did. I've done the freelance thing as well. What was it like for you going out on your own, starting your own business? You have the experience, you have the knowledge. What was it like for you, though? Because I know running your own business can be quite scary, but did you find it, like, was a lot easier than what you expected, or no?
It was very challenging. It was one of the scariest and craziest things I've ever done, was decide to go out on my own. And, you know, I have to caveat and say I'm very lucky. I have a very supportive partner who has given me the, you know, the room to be able to do this and, you know, the guidance. He's there when I'm crying at midnight trying to make it work. And I'm very lucky to have that. But I think I just got to a point, and I know we spoke about this offline before, I got to a point of complete burnout, and I realized that something had to change. I was running my London and Dubai team from Singapore. The time difference was killing me, but so was the workload. And I had just got to a point where I was so unhappy, but I didn't realize it. And I needed to change. I needed to make a change. And you often need to hit rock bottom, don't you, before you can rise up again and do something different. And it was really empowering to make the decision that I would do something for myself and try and sort of trust myself to build something. But it was also absolutely terrifying. And I think that first year, so I'm sort of a year and a half into having my business now, the first year was completely like, let's see what happens. Let's try different things. And I think you were speaking about it before. I didn't quite know who my client base was. I didn't know exactly what my offering was, you know, to use all those buzzwords, but I didn't know at all what I was doing. And I was in a country which I really didn't know at all. So I just had to try a whole heap of different things to see what would stick, what would work. And the thing that I realized was the most effective was networking. So Singapore has a huge amount of networking groups and things like that. And I just went to everything. I put myself in all sorts of rooms and drinks and coffees. And as much as it was uncomfortable and as much as some of it I hated, it was the way that I've been able to find clients, find, you know, find people to work with, and also get that kind of that trust factor as well. So the networking has been hugely important. But yeah, the last year and a half, I have learned so much about running a business. You know, I've done my own taxes, I've done my own, you know, visa applications, all those funny things, to also actually learning a huge amount about yourself. So it's been amazing, but it's been challenging. And I'm just really looking forward to kind of building and scaling in a different way. That's my sort of next step. And I think, again, you just have to double down and get on with it. But it certainly has been a roller coaster. And I'm sure you probably found the same.
I'm actually curious to go back to that roller coaster point, because you talked about burnout and how you didn't even realize you're burnt out. Was it something like, I've certainly had, yeah, my moments, and it would be partners or maybe best friends that told me, and it wasn't until they kind of gave me a bit of a shakedown that I was like, yeah, you're actually right. Like, you know what? Like, I am burning the wick at both ends. Was that kind of a situation that happened with you, or was it kind of like you came to the end of the week and you're like, you know what? I don't even know if I can open up my laptop and even look at it anymore. What was kind of the situation? What was the kicker for you? It was like, something has to change.
Yeah, it was definitely that. And I think it was crazy. We had gone back to the UK for a friend's wedding. We were actually in Italy for their wedding. And we'd had a week of working in the UK. I'd been back in my office. And I was supposed to have a week off in Italy for this wedding, all our friends back together. And we were sitting having lunch and, you know, beautiful surroundings, all very wonderful. And I was on my phone, my work phone, and I was so anxious and I couldn't eat the food, which is such a shame, obviously, in Italy. And and I was just having the most miserable time. And I was so nervous and anxious and strung out from all these emotions. And I'd spoken to my mum the week previously and she had been quite worried. And then my partner just looked at me and he went, we can't, like, this can't continue. You can't continue the way you are, and you are a different person. And I thought initially, you know, you're very defensive and, you know, of course your job means everything. And it takes a little while for that to sink in. But I think when the people around you, as you say, tell you and identify it, that's when I looked at myself properly and thought, this isn't sustainable. And what am I even doing? What am I working for? You know, I'm not changing the world. And actually destroying myself every day and having that anxiety, as you said, to check your emails every morning, it's not worth living that way. And through my work in Singapore, I've met a lot, especially a lot of women, but a lot of people who have gone through that corporate burnout and have come out of the other side, and they've reinvented themselves, whether they've retrained, they've actually found a new lease on life or done something different. I think there is a huge issue with probably our generation and the generation above us going through corporate burnout and just destroying ourselves. And then you have to pick yourself up and put yourself back together and find a new way to move forward. So I think it's a huge lesson for a lot of people that identifying it, hopefully you identify it before you hit rock bottom, but there's actually nothing wrong with getting to that point, because how can you rebuild unless you kind of hit the bottom and then go from there? So I feel very lucky that that happened, and I've gone through it. I know people, you know, who had it far worse than I, but it's certainly a learning curve. And I think being able to identify it and get off that merry-go-round and do something different if you can would be the big lesson there. But yeah, sorry to also hear that you've gone through that, because it's tough.
Yeah, and I think it comes from a mentality of, and you touched on it very early on in this conversation, was stubbornness. I think a lot of us do have the stubbornness and thinking that by us almost accepting the fact that we're burnt out, we're giving up in a sense, which isn't actually the case. It's actually more actually accepting, like, this isn't normal. This should not be the normal. And you'd certainly, yeah, like you said, you don't have to break yourself backwards and kill yourself just for the sake of a job and a salary and everything else. Like, there needs to be a means to an end, and certainly a more healthier way of approaching everything. And maybe that is also a mix of the media industry in general, because media and comms and everything else can be quite stressful as a whole, but that does not mean that should be the normal or the expectation or anything else. And I think you're right. Generationally, I think it's a problem, because I certainly know people that are in their 20s, or guys that I know that have worked in teams with me, they could not give a shit. They work for themselves. And I don't mean that in a mean way. I'm meaning in the sense where mental health is their main priority. It is not about the company, and it doesn't show loyalty by you breaking your back over like getting some work done. If anything, it just shows that you're silly enough to allow that to happen to yourself, when realistically, I'm sure your company would prefer that you were there for another day, not that you wrote that email at 3 o'clock in the morning.
Yes. Yeah, I think it's a really good point. And definitely that sort of the next generation, the generation Gen Z and things like that, they have boundaries already. They have all of that kind of worked out. And as you say, they close their laptop, they're done for the day. They don't start before 9, you know, and not, I know that's a bit of a over-exaggeration, but I know with my teams of younger people, that's how they felt about work, which, you know, power to you. We just weren't brought up to be like that. We were brought up to be the last ones in the office. We were the ones that were pushed, you know, you have to work, you have to hustle, you have to work as hard as you can. That's how you're going to progress. And I think it takes a lot actually to unlearn all of that behavior, because that's how we were all told that you had to succeed and that was the only way you were going to do anything. So it takes a long time to unlearn all of that. You know, eventually we learn to put some boundaries in place. I mean, I certainly am struggling with a lot of that. I don't have that down pat at all, but I do have a better understanding of work-life balance. And I think that's important to try and have that.
And do you feel, in a sense, by you starting your own business, it gives you a lot more power to kind of take that back in a sense as well? Because the only person you really have to worry about in that sense is yourself. Like, you're driving yourself. It's not like you have someone hanging over your head saying like, oh, Charlotte, we're cutting the cord, your contract's not getting extended, because at the end of the day, you're in control of your own future. Is that kind of like the nicety of running your own company and running your own business, is knowing you're ultimately the person that decides when you hang up the phone or when you log off for the day?
Yeah, it is nice to have that. And I think you're working for yourself. So, you know, if I'm working late most nights of the week, then that's for me to build something for me. So that's definitely a lot more of a motivator. The downside of not having the person sort of hanging over your head or anything is that it is all on you. And if you make a mistake or you don't do something, there's no one else around to particularly help, or, you know, it's all on you. And so you also have to be very motivated. And, you know, so on the days when you don't want to do something, if you don't do it, that impacts you so much more than, you know, if you're part of a team. So it sort of swings and roundabouts, I guess. There's really good points and some parts that are more difficult, but it's just navigating that and understanding and putting processes in place and maybe also looking at where you need support. And that's sort of where I am at the moment. You're trying to look at what might be better to outsource, who you could maybe bring in to help, and all of those things, which is all part of that learning curve of starting your own business.
Yeah, definitely. And I think the other thing I'd love to touch on is you talked about networking and you're doing a hell of a lot. You've been going to things like Radio Days, which are massive events in terms of other people that are in industry trying to meet each other. Do you find that since you've been a solopreneur, like running your own business and working out there, that you're finding a lot more kind of new avenues and new information that you're able to learn from like networking with other people that maybe traditionally you wouldn't have networked with if you'd stayed with working in a company?
Yes, definitely. And I think networking, especially somewhere like this, it's so powerful, but it also creates that, and you sort of touched on it before when you were saying about having, you know, that real connection with other people. The networking groups here have been incredibly supportive, not just on a kind of work level, but also personally. And to have that connection with people that you've met to support you in different ways, you know, when days are tough, is really important, I think, for sort of a solo entrepreneur. And I think by what I've learned through the networking side of things as well is that you can kind of boost yourself up. It's so cool to go to these events and meet people and then also find ways in which you can help other people. And I remember reading something a while ago and it really helped me reframe how I looked at networking, which was all about you should never go into it expecting anything, but you should go in, you know, you shouldn't expect to get a deal or sign something off, but you should go in there with an idea of what you want to get out of it and what you want someone to get out from you. And I think reframing that's really nice to understand that maybe someone could introduce me to someone. Maybe someone has a tip or a trick for me, and maybe I can help someone as well. And that way you never go into something or come out of it feeling like it was a waste of time. So you definitely have to reframe the way you look at networking sometimes, but I think it's an incredibly powerful tool to build connections that will stay with you for a long time.
Yeah, my other company, it's like, yeah, I completely agree with you. I think going into networking events with this mentality of being like, I'm going to make money off these five people that I'm going to meet today is just like a really poor form way of doing it, when in actuality, it's much like the podcasting thing. You've got to be consistent, keep turning up, keep putting it out there. You might not get anything for months on end, but maybe a year down the track, something might crop up. I love that, Charlotte. I think that's really cool that that's kind of your approach to also the networking side of things. And in terms of if people wanted to get a hold of you, Charlotte, and they want to work with you, they want to be consulted by you, coached, and learn the strategies of putting together branded podcasts and putting together their own content, how can they get in contact with you and how can they learn more about like the work that you do?
Oh, well, thank you. And yes, absolutely. If anybody is interested, please do reach out. So you can reach me through LinkedIn or my email is charlotte@clwmedia.com. I'm sure we'll pop that in the sort of the notes or the description. I am currently getting a website built at the moment, so that's in progress. But definitely LinkedIn and email is probably the best way to get in touch. And I'm always up for a call or a coffee just to have a chat about things and just understand a bit more about what people are looking for.
If you like the podcast, I'd love for you to leave a 5-star review on your preferred podcast platform and let me know your thoughts on the show. Don't forget, you can reach out to me via Instagram at beyondbroadcastpod or via email at beyondbroadcastpod@gmail.com. Until next time, take it easy.